For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Sitting opposite me on the morning show today is Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country, and some newspapers outside the country as well. And he is also a frequent visitor to UWM up in Milwaukee, and of course a monthly visitor to the morning show. And Professor Sear, it's good to welcome you back to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Berg. It's always a great pleasure to be with you. Certainly always pleasant.
And I'm glad that Mother Nature changed her plans for a big blizzard, and so it was nothing in the way of serious weather that kept you from us today.
Thank Mother Nature. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
I know that one of the things we wanted to give you a chance to mention, and let's do it now before we run out of time, is that the mock trial team at Carthage recently scored a gratifying success. Maybe you can describe what that success was, and maybe ahead of that, just describe for any of our listeners who aren't acquainted with it, just what the mock trial program at Carthage is all about.
It's a very intense debate program, which mimics or imitates or recreates in a very realistic form trial procedures in court. So it is an experience in debate and an experience in the law and courtroom procedure. It's very worthwhile, like everything we do at Carthage College in one way or another. Certainly very educational, and it's very useful for students who are interested in law school, but also I believe strongly in preparing students for life after leaving the very special environment of a very fine liberal arts college. Michael Fegley, who was a longtime colleague of ours in management and marketing, and also a municipal judge in this immediate area, and a practicing attorney in Racine. The judgeship is in Mount Pleasant. He's built a practice in criminal and family and other areas of the law over some years in a very demanding environment just to the north of us. He's an extremely gifted teacher, leader, and coach, as well as attorney. And the program has developed such that we now, for the first time, have an opportunity to go to national competition, which we did last year. And it looks like we're going there again this year. We just had a very intense weekend for our students and coaches at Hamline University up in the Twin Cities. And speaking of the weather, when we were there last year, I well remember the very intense blizzard that was going on. I got lost at least once between these look-alike big university buildings, but somehow they managed to get me back as well. The weather was great this weekend. meteorological and otherwise, the human environment can be quite inspiring given the intensity. It's rather like athletics in some ways.
Hmm. So they are doing well once again, and it might be time for us to have Mike Fegley back on the program to talk
and
about
students.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
he has unusual leadership abilities. He's got a real gift for drawing people. Larry Keating, a local court commissioner as well as attorney, has been his assistant coach for quite a while now. Megan Zinkovich, an attorney and public defender in Milwaukee, has now joined the team. These people are not highly compensated, if at all, but even I could see that Michael has really distinctive leadership abilities, and again, that are particularly important in academia, in my highly biased opinion. Other students come back. Josh Klindert, who was a leader of the team last year, a co-captain with Maham Ali, who was also back. He's a law student at Marquette in Milwaukee, but I'm very impressed that he not only comes to our tournaments, but he treks down to Kenosha for practices. Maham, who was a star student in IPE and otherwise, is working closely with Jennifer Madden while completing her in management, while completing the management degree that we now offer in business design and in business innovation, business design and innovation. And teamwork is key, especially in our environment, I believe. And again, Professor Fegley's ability to generate this, a human talent, as much as anything else, has really been of great benefit to the college.
Terrific.
So thank you very much.
I'm glad glad they are enjoying yet another successful season. And, yeah, it would be fun to catch up with them and hear more about that.
Yes,
work.
And the long-term trend is up. I'll try to restrain myself in just another minute or two. But the last time we were at Nationals, the two finalists were the University of Virginia and Yale. There are a few small colleges, including Carleton College, up near the Twin Cities in Minnesota. A traditional powerhouse, but it's unusual for a small college to be in this position. And we all of us have to try to target what makes the most sense when we're trying to build a team, and I'm personally quite gratified that this has worked well, along with Enactus and Model UN and other initiatives that faculty are taking.
Very good. All right, let's get to some issues and concerns and headlines and so on, and of course, a very big story yesterday, of course, was the fall that we saw on Wall Street. And, of course, you were careful to point out that in terms of total percentage of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it was not a catastrophic plunge, but it's a bigger plunge than we typically see. But
It's only about 3%, which is important to keep in mind since the market value has been so high for now so many years. Look at the percentages, Greg, not just the absolute numbers that the media emphasize.
Right.
And that alarm a lot of people.
Right. The real reason I wanted to talk about it today is not so much, that particular number of 1,000-plus points, but because you're right, it's important to put it in perspective. But the fact that it appears that that fall was due to concerns about the coronavirus. And that seems like something that is worth talking about, not even so much the coronavirus itself or what our concerns should be about that, but the fact that we seem to be seeing some economic ramifications beyond just sort of the specific human toll of numbers of people who've contracted the coronavirus, the numbers who have passed away, and some of the concerns that have spread to other countries. But the fact that something like this can have economic impact, in a sense, to just about every corner of the globe, that, I think, is something worth talking about. What's your sense of the significance of this?
My sense, Greg, is I know you're concerned. I share your concern. It is one factor involved in what we call globalization. Public health problems can spread fairly quickly. The disease is concentrated in China. It appears to have peaked in China. Let's pay close attention again to the specific numbers in terms of infections and deaths elsewhere in the world. These come up regularly and always have for various reasons that have as much to do with business as public health. The media focus intense, sustained attention on these matters as long as it's newsworthy and helps ratings. We do have this very, very serious disease now. We also had Ebola not too long ago. We had West Nile virus not too long ago. We had Legionnaire's disease a while ago, Greg. These things do come up. The most serious such matter, as far as I know, in the 20th century, in the 19th century and before, disease and death widespread were just a natural part of the challenge of human existence. There was a global influenza epidemic right after World War I, spread by the really horrible human conditions in trench warfare in Europe. And it was a global war, especially in terms of British Empire troops involved. There was an influenza epidemic that was really very serious that affected the United States, which historically is relatively immune to the kind of pestilence of the rest of the world. And one reason a lot of people want to come here, 300,000 Americans died, didn't get sick. They died in the years at the end of and right after World War I. I believe that's the most serious we've had. Fortunately for all of us, it was a century ago. But again, Greg, I understand your concern and certainly know why people are so concerned, and I am too, not to be minimized.
I appreciate that. I think really what I'm talking about, I'm not talking about whether or not we should be worried about the coronavirus itself. What I'm really asking you about is the way in which we are feeling some economic repercussions.
Well, we haven't yet. I mean, that's yesterday's headlines and continuing in the news cycle today, but let's see how the markets perform. Futures are up this morning. I take a look at these things. Not every day, but I know you always ask about it. So, yeah, we'll see how the market performs. But 1,000 points, given the total valuation of Wall Street, that's not much.
Right. It was just, I guess, what I thought was striking was reports cited about the fact that, you know, when you are shuttering factories in China because of... But the fact that shutting down a production factory in China affects us in a way that, you know, in 1918, whatever the horrific human cost of that epidemic was, we did not have, in a sense, the interconnectedness in which...
Quite right. That's a very good point.
So that's really what I'm asking
about. I'm very glad you made that point. Thank you.
All right, we'll go on. One of the things you wrote about most recently is about the United Kingdom making its exit from the European Union finally. Brexit has actually occurred, but now what ensues, according to your column anyway, is a year of transition where something gets negotiated in terms of what this new relationship will be. So help us understand kind of the task that is before them, that is the United Kingdom and the European Union.
Boris Johnson is, I guess, kind of a conventional politician to an extreme degree. These public policy matters, especially involving economics, trade, and immigration, are very complicated, especially in modern times. We live in a complicated global economy and society. And so what politicians do is they kick the can down the road. His hapless predecessor, good, serious, stolid Theresa May, I picture her as a mainstay of a stable, pleasant, upper-middle-class British suburb. Great compliment to her political skill. To a degree, she managed to become leader of the Tory Party. She spent hours in civil servants and her senior political advisors, including round-the-clock days, negotiating and developing very detailed proposals for leaving the European Union. Three times she did it. She rolled the rock up the hill, and the House of Commons, by large majorities, refused to go along with these detailed agreements and knocked her over, and she went rolling back down the hill. Boris Johnson avoided all that. He went blasting to Brussels, got a general agreement on principles that the UK was going to leave. The EU came back home and declared victory, won a general election. Meanwhile, the details have to be worked out. So the endlessly patient bureaucrats and eurocrats in Brussels, the men and women who run the European Union, this confederation, of states of Europe, as I'm sure our listeners know, they gave Boris and Associates a year to negotiate the departure. So as of January 31st, you're right, Britain left the European Union, but they still have a year to work out the details and try to ease the pain of with actual withdrawal, the withdrawal from their involvement with the EU.
So can you just give us at least a rough sense of what kind of details we're talking about that need to be worked out?
Well, technically, the European Union, which has protectionist barriers against the rest of the world, these tariffs will now go up, but my understanding is not right away, against Britain. There's a range of professional licensing agreements related to doctors and lawyers and engineers, nurses, all kinds of professionals. Those are automatically recognized on the continent and in Britain. No longer the case. Immigration has been a big issue in Britain, as it has been here. People will no longer be able freely to move between the continent and Britain. Especially given Prime Minister Johnson's style, my fear is that we'll be getting into the fall of this year and nothing will actually have been done as he, like our president, flies around making speeches and causing controversy and drawing attention to himself. The civil servants on both sides, I think, will probably reasonably work something out.
You mentioned in your column about...
I hope that's clear. It's not a subject on which... It's highly technical, and I'm not a technical expert on this particular subject, and fortunately don't have to be.
Right. You specifically mentioned in your column that Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union.
As did Wales. And Northern Ireland.
Right. And so... what do you see as the ramifications of Brexit when it comes to, for instance, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales? And what does this potentially do to their relationship with London?
Always tense in the last half century, especially. Historically, extremely tense. I think those tensions will grow, and there'll be moves in Scotland, as there are already. Declarations of trying to work out a separate agreement with the EU because it is politically popular. But there are only about 5 million people in Scotland, a very influential 5 million people, I must say, historically and currently. But they are and very good at maintaining independence from England. It was an agreed settlement after literally not just decades, but centuries of bloody warfare in the 1700s that led Scotland to agree to join England. But it was a negotiated settlement. It wasn't a surrender. I think it will continue to be vexatious. Johnson has been adamant that there will be no second referendum on leaving the European Union in Scotland. On leaving the United Kingdom in Scotland. They had a referendum on leaving the United Kingdom, not to be confused with a referendum on the EU, which I just misspoke about. And there was a bare majority in favor of staying in the partnership with Britain. Yeah. Well, I must say, our good British friends, it's become increasingly confusing to keep up with everything they're up to.
Right. Well, and it would be interesting to know. I mean, it'd be interesting to know like what goes through the mind of someone in Scotland in terms of should we stay or should we leave? I mean, like, what are they?
Well, like other things in politics, it's very emotional. Economically, the British have decided unwisely, in my personal opinion, to put all their eggs in a couple of baskets, these large strategic nuclear submarines, which the Americans developed thanks to President Eisenhower primarily, and have been a mainstay of our nuclear arsenal since the 1960s. The British have decided to give tremendous emphasis to those, and they are based in Scotland, a big expense for Britain, even though we've helped to underwrite. We certainly underwrote the development costs. They don't really have the size of the economy, and as you were indicating, especially in our global world, they're highly integrated with the rest of the United Kingdom. It's not practical for them to leave. They would be leaving the British pound and undertaking the euro. They were a very small economy compared to the rest of the EU, and I don't think they have the diversity to really sustain independence. But politics is highly emotional, as we know.
Right. And you were saying that the...
If it weren't so emotional, we'd have economists and accountants and, best of all, actuaries would be running things.
Right.
But that's not how it works.
No. And you were saying that their vote was, I think you characterized it as relatively close.
Yes, it was. Yeah, just like the vote to leave the European Union.
Wow. Something to watch. For those of you just joining us, my guest on the morning show is Dr. Art Seer Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center. This is his monthly visit to the program. And it was since your last visit that the United States Senate voted to acquit President Trump on the articles of impeachment brought to them by the U.S. House. I don't remember if it was just before or just after that vote was taken that you wrote a piece that kind of took the long view of impeachment and reminded all of us about the first time a United States president was impeached, namely our 17th president, Andrew Johnson, who, of course, followed in the footsteps of Abraham Lincoln, not very capably, but you point out in your column that he became president at an exceedingly difficult point in time, and chances are President Lincoln himself, had he not been assassinated, would have had struggles of his own in that really, really tough period. But I want you to explain to our listeners the comparison that you drew between that impeachment proceeding in the mid-19th century and the impeachment proceedings that have occurred more than a century later, and how you see them as being very different.
Lincoln was assassinated only about a week after the surrender of Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, the principal field army of the Confederate States of America. There were other armies in the field. Western Army, which had been driven into South Carolina by Sherman's overwhelming force. After they took Atlanta, they moved north. Joseph Johnston didn't surrender until much later, after a lot of haggling with General Sherman, who, unlike Grant and Lee, Sherman went way beyond his orders and tried to get a comprehensive peace settlement overruled by Washington. There was a lot of turmoil, literally. There was economic devastation through a large part of the South, especially in particular the urban centers, and there were units in the field that didn't stop fighting till late in the year. The last Confederate army to surrender, commanded by a Native American, I believe, in Texas, was until later on in the summer.
Wow.
So there was still a war going on. Andrew Johnson had been picked, as I mentioned in the column, because Lincoln was ever sensitive to always looking far ahead in comprehensive terms, a true genius. He had a very nice, rather mild-mannered, not entertaining, named Hannibal Hamlin from New England, the center of anti-slavery sentiment, as his running mate in 1860. The war victory was in sight by the 1864 election. There was still a good chance Lincoln would lose. And he managed, with absolutely no waves at all on the surface, to unload good old Mr. Hamlin. And Andrew Johnson was a Democrat in a border state, Tennessee, who had very strong, impressive military credentials, was also a slave owner. He freed his slaves in 1863, I think, when... Tennessee was occupied by federal troops, but it had been a Confederate state. And Johnson, in effect, on his own, freed his slaves. He was intensely committed to the Union, a very emotional man. He was emotionally very hostile to the Confederacy. So from our privileged perch, you and I, we can look at someone who was ideal in terms of drawing in Democrats and people politically on the fence and literally in the border states to support Lincoln and the Reconstruction efforts that he was already planning. Unfortunately, even by the hard-drinking standards of the time, President Lincoln stood out as a teetotaler because Americans drank huge amounts of alcohol, including not just in the bar, but in in the well of chamber of the House and the Senate and on the Supreme Court, for God's sake. Anyway, Johnson was a very heavy drinker. He was a very belligerent, rigid man and made to order for the radical Republicans to take out after him. The stakes were very, very high compared to the, in my opinion, more recent impeachments. And the whole experience was so horrible. Johnson was acquitted in the Senate. He was impeached by the House. He was tried in the Senate. Two-thirds votes are necessary. One Republican senator made the difference. His career was thereafter over. In politics, he did well professionally. But it was an extremely, extremely hate-filled, extremely violent time when the stakes of the survival of our Union were still there. The Confederates had surrendered, but the whole country was a mess in terms of true national unity. So it's a lot of background. I tend to speak at length, but this is really important.
It's fascinating.
To my mind, contrasts dramatically with the Clinton, Trump, and even Nixon impeachment efforts.
So I'm not terribly surprised to hear you contrast the two most recent as, you know, I think in your words, you know, you see them as more casual and cynical. I'm a little surprised that you group the Nixon impeachment movement in similar terms, but that's how you feel?
Well, maybe I should. The president committed a felony, Nixon. That's undeniable, obstruction of justice, and then he really is a fascinating personality. Entirely voluntary, he put everything on tape. So he hanged himself with these audio recordings. Therefore, it was serious. I do think it was a reflection of his weakness and also the political atmosphere at the time that Congress seized on this. Richard Nixon was so controversial. I happen to think he was a very, great's the wrong word, but a very important and significant president in policy terms for a lot of policy, good policy reasons. And now that's not a controversial point of view. But he was a widely mistrusted figure, even in his own party. So once he became weak, the administration went down very quickly. Also, the person at the top sets the tone, for good or bad. I concluded that very early in my life, and it's only been confirmed in the years since. And Nixon's flaw, reflecting his own paranoia and other character weaknesses, he hired people that should never have been in the White House or anywhere near the President of the United States, including John Dean, who I believe was a principal disbarred lawyer, who I believe was a principal culprit in the actual Watergate crime and related activity, G. Gordon Liddy, who was one of the principal crooks, you know, directly working for the way. He should stay away from those men. And Nixon ultimately brought himself down in Shakespearean terms for those reasons.
So the impeachments of President Clinton and President Trump, you would not characterize in the same way. And again, in your column, you used the words casual and cynical in terms
by some of the politicians involved. Sure, the Civil War was such a terrible trauma for this country. 600,000 dead during the course of the war, far more costly than any other war for us, including World War II. And the national trauma was so great, and the impeachment related thereto, therefore, was seen as such a destructive experience that we went for more than a century before there was an impeachment, and it was thanks, unfortunately, because of Richard Nixon. I think the blame falls on him that it became more acceptable after the turmoil of the 60s and 70s, very real, not as bad as the Civil War, but pretty bad.
So in other words, you think we have forgotten what the cost is if one is to impeach and ultimately remove a president from office?
Yeah, that's right. I don't. My opinion, and it's just mine, obviously, is that neither Clinton nor Trump engaged in activity that rose to an impeachable offense under the intentionally ambiguous language of the Founding Fathers in our Constitution. Clinton did break the law. He perjured himself. But I don't think that was the kind of action that justifies removing a president. And it's the atmosphere. It's the atmosphere since Watergate. We've lowered the bar, in effect, to try to put it briefly for a change. We've lowered the bar concerning what is impeachable.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Artsir Klossen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, and touching on a lot of important matters in this hour. Well, we, of course, because of his acquittal, we do still have President Trump very much with us, and he needs a Democratic opponent come November. And one of your most recent columns was about kind of the flawed performance of Iowa when it came to its own caucuses that set off the whole primary season. And you said, as far as you could tell, the only winner in the Iowa caucuses was the Republican Party. Can you expand on that?
Well, sure. The results were divided, but there were also technical problems that meant that the not only drama, but also politically significant results from Iowa were stuttering and slow and uneven and didn't come out, and there's a recount, and it's made to order for President Trump. You don't have to have any particular insight, and he's taken full advantage of it by sneering and making demeaning comments about the caucuses in Iowa. They've become very important. Very few people participate in these, indeed, compared to primaries generally. And Bill Clinton is a dramatic example of a brilliant politician who I believe lost both Iowa and New Hampshire in 1992 and was able to come back.
So although we're going to explore this in more detail with Professor Jerry Mass tomorrow on the morning show.
That's good. Yeah. Yes, he came to mind when you asked me that question.
But I'm just curious if you have any impressions of how this struggle has been waged thus far in terms of the crowded Democratic field, which is now not quite so crowded as it was before.
Well, it's hard to say anything that's new or interesting. I think it's a very healthy sign for our great republic that despite all the turmoil and all the terrible ordeals involved in seeking and winning the presidency, we still have a lot of people who want to do it. And when there's not an incumbent in both parties, I think that's a very healthy sign. It's another legacy of the 60s. We were discussing Nixon and Watergate. Because of steady historic pressures for more direct representation in our system, something that the founders clearly feared and wanted to avoid, we've evolved historically into a much more direct democracy. In 1960, John Kennedy was touted afterwards by a very sympathetic media in those days as the hero of the primaries. He decisively won exactly two. We had less than a dozen in the country, Wisconsin and West Virginia, with the two pivotal ones. In fact, that very well organized operation targeted and, in hindsight, was extremely talented at projecting an unknown candidate, public figure onto the stage, largely unbelievable, but true. Thanks to 1968 and the violence and trauma of that year, Lyndon Johnson, a sitting president who could have won again, withdrew. Eugene McCarthy, who deserves a lot of credit, he generally doesn't get, initially challenged him. After McCarthy wounded him in New Hampshire, Robert Kennedy came off the fence and jumped in. They fought bitter primaries, the ones that were available in those days, until Kennedy's assassination in early June 1968. Meanwhile, Hubert Humphrey lined up a majority of the Democratic delegates without entering any primaries at all. As a result of that trauma, and also longer-term trends, the Democrats moved to, in effect, having primaries in some caucuses across the country. And by 72, they carried out that revolution, and the Republicans soon followed suit. So that's the structure that we have today. They're not really debates that occur. In my this week's column, which I managed to finish yesterday, it's a TV show. It's a traveling reality TV show, crucial to the election of someone like Donald Trump, who would have been unacceptable even a few decades ago. to people generally and to the media. Reality TV now defines our politics. They're not debates, they're television shows. And the media drives melodrama, not discussion of the issues. That's my grumpy old opinion. People should make up their own minds, but think about how useful this is. It means there's an opportunity for someone to come from nowhere, as Jimmy Carter did in 76, and as Bill Clinton did in 92. And they're all to be respected, in my view, but it's a very different process. In my view, not really representative, because very few people vote in primaries. And the mass media is not part of mainstream American society. The mainstream media is not part of our mainstream, and Trump brilliantly, with 2020 hindsight, appreciated that in 2016.
That he did.
Yeah.
Let's move on to some other things.
Are you sure you don't want to voice a different view?
No.
It's, okay.
We're here to hear your view. since your last visit, you wrote about a comprehensive trade agreement hammered out between the United States and Mexico and Canada. And you paint for us a really complicated picture of what that agreement is essentially all about, and also tell us something about the support from both sides of the aisle that ultimately made it possible. So,
well, I'm very glad you asked that question, as Richard Nixon liked to say. I know I come across like a grumpy old man. This column was about important bipartisan positive legislation in Congress. It is actually a law. It's actually a treaty passed by both houses. Chief executives in recent times, starting especially with George W. Bush, executive agreements, you know, it's a lot easier. You don't have to deal with anybody much except yourself and your staff, and you declare this thing, and then the next guy comes in and gets rid of them all. It's a capsule discussion description of Obama and then Trump. Legislation treaties are very hard to hammer out with very few headlines. While we're concentrating on the media roadshow of the quest for the presidency by Democrats, Congress worked diligently to get this bipartisan legislation passed. A very large proportion of Republicans and Democrats got together. Some notable presidential candidates, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are protectionists, reflecting some important modern currents, voted against it. But it was a bipartisan victory for a reasonable trade, particularly important given the fact that the president has made, as we all know, protectionism and raising barriers, including literally the absurd wall on the Mexican border, a principal theme. As soon as he started talking that way about NAFTA, Mitch McConnell, like him or not, a very brilliant and powerful congressional leader, he immediately spoke out publicly against the president and said, "Don't mess with this, Mr. President. This is very much in the public interest, and if you decide to do battle on this, you will suffer an embarrassing defeat." He put it more diplomatically. But it's our system working the way it should be. I obviously support this kind of agreement. I do think it's in the interests of Americans generally, including working people. A lot of the political rhetoric is a distortion of reality. But I really am glad you asked that question. It shows that the system does work.
It occasionally works.
Yeah, on very important matters. The vast majority of Supreme Court decisions are not 5-4. These emotionally charged, highly politicized decisions often are today. But the vast majority are 9-0, 8-1, 7-2. There is an underlying stability to which reflects the wisdom of the people who put together our Constitution.
So how is it that that are two parties who can't seem to agree on anything and can scarcely manage to function in just about anything manage to come together on this particular matter? What was it about a trade agreement that made it possible for Democrats and Republicans to to align? I mean, we just hardly ever see that anymore.
Well, that's a very good question. They're very powerful economic interest groups, including corporate groups, but not exclusively, who have benefited from the original NAFTA treaty. Consumer prices are relatively low compared to even two or three decades ago in this country in real terms. Having a global economy means that consumer goods, including durables like cars, refrigerators, other expensive long-term items, are less expensive than they were, certainly for our parents and grandparents, but even for us, not too long ago. And my theory, as a professor, is that that tends to diffuse protectionist sentiments. I don't minimize the human misery of workers who've been displaced. You and I are rather privileged people in society, and when you're getting a paycheck and are still relatively secure in life, it's very easy to go around preaching. But in point of fact, it's automation, not picking up a factory in Kenosha and moving it south of the border to Mexico. It is automation and extremely efficient production that is displacing traditional industrial workers. Those jobs are going away. They're not, with some exceptions, they're not going off to third world countries. It is extremely disruptive in Kenosha. Until fairly recent years, until fairly recent times, you didn't even have a high school degree. Until well after World War II, you could, like your dad and your granddad, you could get a job on the line at American Motors, make a good living, thanks to a very impressive and very decent union, the United Auto Workers. It was a very stable life, and that, of course, has all been thrown away. The genius of our economy is innovation, invention, and change. People still live pretty well in southeast Wisconsin because the local establishment and everybody's favorite whipping boy government encouraged changes that have, in this immediate area at least, have ensured continued high employment long term. So protectionism, you mentioned the decline of the market. The Smoot-Hawley tariff was passed early in the Great Depression. It was tremendous unilateral trade barriers against foreign goods coming into this country. Protectionist sentiments and fear was so great. President Hoover was against it. Roosevelt was against this kind of protectionism. But FDR in particular didn't fight it because it was so powerful. The stock market crash of 29 was followed by another for serious decline, and the market hit rock bottom. I mean a decline of not 1,000 points. It's a small percentage, but a decline of 70 and 80% of the values on Wall Street, and it stayed down through the 30s. National protectionism had a lot to do with that, and we're light years away from that now. Right. I hope it's clear because it's extremely hard even for highly sophisticated people. Yeah, in economics, which I'm not, to make these concepts clear. So I hope it's clear. But that's why NAFTA went through. The USMCA, US-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the new NAFTA, went through fairly easily. And most things happen that way today thanks to the cushion of wealth and prosperity in this country.
I don't remember if it was NAFTA or a trade agreement that came shortly after that, but one of the things that was so striking about that was that there was some kind of ceremony, statement of support, and again, either for NAFTA or for something that came right after NAFTA. And I remember that there were Democrat and Republican former presidents who stood in a row as the current president spoke in favor of this trade agreement. And I just remember thinking, wow, I mean, there's not a long list of things where you would find agreement between President Carter and President Reagan and President Bush. And but here they are lined up behind this trade agreement. And it's just kind of striking, especially in the divisive times in which we live.
At the same time, these disruptive forces shouldn't be minimized. I had the good fortune, well, we had the good fortune at Carthage to host Bernie Sanders in 2016. And I was not able, given other obligations, I wasn't able to get in line really early in the morning. So I joined the line, which snaked around our not single file, but two, three, four people together, went all the way around our track and disappeared down Sheridan Road. He filled the very large Tarbell Athletic Center, as you probably recall. It was a fascinating experience, but I had a chance to talk to people in line. It wasn't just older people. There were an awful lot of young people there, including people who hadn't finished high school or who were high school graduates who were really struggling. And they found his message appealing, not because they're irresponsible and not because they're fools, but because they're having a really hard time in life. He's also not to be underestimated as a very, very shrewd tactician and an old-fashioned tub-thumping orator who really gets the audience with him, thanks to somebody in our communication staff who noticed me and opened a side door. I write about these things, so I got in to hear the speech as well, the best of both worlds. And I'm not a Sanders supporter, and I do think his message is unwise. But I can see his appeal. He's not to be underestimated. A lot of overlap with Trump in terms of basic rhetorical style and ability to sense an audience. Unlike Trump, he's extremely well organized on the ground. I've been getting weekly emails from Bernie since 2016. I have not contributed to his campaign. All I did was RSVP, as the campaign shrewdly insisted. Everybody from Carthage had to RSVP, and I hear from Brother Bernie constantly as a result.
Good for you. Very good. We just have 2 minutes for this, but I know you always enjoy talking about South Korea. And you wrote recently about their often overlooked president, Moon Jae-in, and you called him a person of discipline and courage. Two things that come in handy with a leader. Just your closing thoughts on why we should appreciate the president of South Korea.
Well, you brought up good news that's not in the headlines. Staying out of the headlines, he's getting a bad press currently, but that's democracy, and especially South Korean democracy. He has diligently worked behind the scenes to bring Kim from North Korea, the dictator there, and our leader together. And not long after the president had been calling the North Korean leader Rocket Man and engaging in other offensive insults of a personal nature, which is his style, they got together. And President Moon was extremely instrumental in putting that together. And he continues to diligently work behind the scenes. The North Korean delegation was present at the Winter Olympics, the Winter Games held in South Korea not long ago. Because he's not in the headlines, do pay attention to him. There are, throughout the Vietnam War, the South Koreans maintained 50,000 troops in South Vietnam. The Japanese were busy capturing the commercial market along with American contractors, as far as I could tell, but the Koreans were almost all combat troops, rightly feared and respected for the way in which they conducted warfare. Not the way we would do it, but the main point is they were there only out of loyalty to the U.S., only out of loyalty to the U.S. There are among our most important allies in the world, along with the Australians and the British and a few others.
It's good to have friends. And on that note, we need to finish out this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Artsir Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clausen Center, and a monthly visitor to the morning show. Professor Sear, as always, I thank you very much for being part of the morning show and for this interesting conversation.
Thank you, Greg. Good to have friends. Good to have listeners. You're both. Thank you.
The time is 8:58 here on WGTD. And tomorrow on the morning show, another faculty colleague from Carthage will be joining us, namely Dr. Gerald Mast, who is a professor of political science at Carthage. And we will be hearing from him about his thoughts on the vigorous campaign for who will be the Democratic presidential nominee to confront President Bill President Donald Trump in the fall. And we'll be talking with him about a wide range of issues related to that tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we remind you that The Morning Show is now available as a podcast via all of the major podcast platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. Be sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.